horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back. Hour two after a Kenny McPeak visit that really hard not to be impressed and to appreciate the daring do, as it were, and making the kind of decisions you make. You got to get in that position, with a horse like Swiss Skydiver, and certainly pays off. Joe Bianca joins us from TDN, and Joe's had a busy week. The only thing Joe wasn't on over the weekend was Face the Nation. Good morning.
Hey, Steve, what's up?
Well, I did let everybody know that unfortunately they can't watch you, so there won't be any room rating that goes on.
that was a fun surprise to wake up to yesterday. That was interesting.
I'd heard references to this, and I had not seen it actually. It did not come across my timeline until I saw it with you. And it's called Room Raider, Rate My Skype Room, and it's got several hundred thousand followers. And they really latched on to something fun because they get screen caps of people's Zoom appearances, and they talk about the decor. And it's not fair, Joe, because they didn't know that you've only recently moved in.
Yeah, no, there was no context whatsoever.
it really, and then it's fun to read the comments. It's really clever. For those that have not seen this, rate my Skype room on Twitter. Joe, rate your Preakness in this case. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, that was great. Like, this is, I said this on the air the other night, that there's been so many negative stories surrounding racing in the past year or two when it comes to the safety issues at Santa Anita, when it comes to the drugs and the FBI indictments. There's just been, it's been a really tough year or two, I think, for racing and the general public. But, by contrast, I think Saturday was pretty much all you could ask for when it comes to a big-time horse race. I mean, to have the filly race against the boys in the first place, but then for that filly to hook up with the Derby winner at the top of the stretch, and those two just have this ding-dong battle down to the line, and the filly digs in the whole way and beats the Derby winner by a nose on the line. I think that's as good as it gets in horse racing, and it's the kind of thing that you don't see in other sports with girls beating the boys and just that kind of stretch battle. Yeah, that's racing at its best. We've seen a lot of racing at its worst the last couple of years, but it was good on that kind of national stage to see it at its best.
Well, and the added drama, not that there wasn't enough, to begin with, it's a classic, and part of the weekend, to me, it seemed like, the Derby's the Derby, and so even the Derby in September, got the requisite mainstream attention. It did feel like the Preakness was up against a more difficult backdrop, which includes the near aftermath of the Stanley Cup playoffs and the NBA going and baseball playoffs and it competed with things that it's not typically competing with. And internally for us as an industry and as horse players, we were signed on and we were invested, but it didn't feel like it was getting the kind of attention it does in its normal position. It certainly was unique, the fact that we were ending the Triple Crown in Baltimore. But, from that standpoint, the race actually more than lived up to its potential.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting scenario because we went from basically having no sports to having an avalanche of sports, almost too much sports. During mid-May, the Preakness would basically have the sports landscape all to itself. I mean, that's kind of that's the dog day. That's the beginning of the dog days of the sports calendar. And this year, there's just so much going on. But I mean, you know, at least in that moment, there wasn't a huge college football game going on. The Stanley Cup Finals had just ended. The NBA Finals weren't until last night. So at least we had that little window to ourselves. But yeah, it's been tough to compete with all the sports going on because it's a deluge, you know.
Going into the race, what was your, you know, what were your thoughts? I didn't get a chance to see what you were suggesting, and you know, there had been plenty of as I said to Kenny, there was plenty of eye rolling that went on with him adding Robbie Alvarado to the equation, and you know, there were people that were looking for an alternative to Authentic. What was your view going in?
I mean, my only impression, really, and I tweeted this on Saturday when I first saw the odds for the Preakness, my only impression was I was surprised at how little money Swiss Scott ever was taking. I mean, I expected her to be about 5-6 to 1, maybe even the third choice after Authentic and Art Collector. So that was super surprising to me to see her in double digits. I mean, even just forgetting that she was fast enough to win the race on all speed figures, I thought the novelty of having a filly in the race would attract a little bit of casual, you know, every once in a while horse player money, and it didn't even seem like she got that. And that was pretty surprising to me, and that was honestly my only impression going into the race, because I thought it was a fairly wide open race, but it wasn't that the favorites were so vulnerable that I thought you had to take a stand. She was the only one that really stuck out as clear value to me, and you know, it just worked out. And you mentioned Robbie Alvarado. I mean, that was a pretty good ride to hit that hole that early and take that chance. And it's, you know, Jerry Bailey was talking about it on the Preakness broadcast about how when something feels right as a jockey, you're usually right. And you don't, when you don't think about it and you just act, that's usually the way to go. And that seems like one of those things where he had the horse to hit the hole, and he said, "I'm just going to go for it now." And that was the winning move, I think. And if he has to go around Authentic and lets him get first run, I don't think that she's going to win that race. But yeah, I thought she was. You know, I like I said, I said this on Twitter. So this isn't a Red Board King move. I was shocked that she was that big of a price.
And it's funny because Tina and I, we were watching, and she said she wanted to go make a bet. And she said, "How about the filly?" I said, "Well," I said, "she's," and I hadn't looked at the odds in probably half an hour, 45 minutes. I didn't really notice that she was that high. And I said, "Well, I don't know. She's probably third choice." And then she said, "Well, she's 11 to 1. I said, 11 to 1. Really? And that surprised me as well, because you know, I like you, I said the same thing. I, you know, that she absolutely fit. I picked her second as, you know, behind Authentic, and you know, it really seemed much like the Derby, Joe. It felt like there were only three contenders: her, Authentic, and Art Collector, and much the Derby was the same way with Honor AP, Tis the Law, and Authentic. And you didn't have to be, you know, trying to anoint somebody to upset the apple cart here. And look at how the numbers came back. I mean, the exotics were tremendous with Jesus's team third.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought Pneumatic was a little bit interesting off of that last race. But, you know, once he was the one that I think took a lot of money that I wasn't expecting. I think he got his price almost cut in half. But, yeah, I mean, it wasn't – there were no huge long shots that I thought were likely to get in the number like we had in the Derby with Mr. Big News. We usually have one or two horses in the Derby that can at least crack the try or the Super. But – yeah, I mean, she was the clear value of the race, and I just don't get it. I don't understand why she wasn't bet. It seemed to be the opposite of the usual thing where the filly takes money because of the novelty of the filly running against the boys. It seemed to be somewhat of the opposite, where it's, you know, people shied away from her because she's a filly against the boys. It was weird.
And similarly, 1,000 Words was taking money that didn't make any sense either. He had been as low as 5-6 to 1 for a good portion of the day, and he ended up floating up to 7 to 1 as third choice. But I thought that was, you know, a little silly, frankly. I'm just looking now. Swiss Skydiver 1170, Max Player 1150, Pneumatic 1120.
The fact that Max Player was shorter than Swiss Skydiver is incredible. Like, forgetting that he's slower than her on every single speed figure, just not having any speed at all. Like, when's the last time you saw a dead closer like that win the Preakness? That's shocking to me.
Well, I did not, when the final analysis came and I wrote up the race, I picked Authentic, and I was pretty convinced that he wasn't going to get that pace pressure issue that everybody seemed to think that he would. And sure enough, and this is the big question, and I guess after talking to Kenny and Beyer, we can kick it around, and Rich Migliori will address it, and I know Tony's going to talk about it later in the week. It seemed to me that John Velasquez did not employ Authentic the way he did in the Derby. And when you had the chance to, you know, really wrest control of the race and utilize his speed to do essentially what he did at Churchill. And instead, not only did he try to rate him on the lead, even though Baffert has said repeatedly he's not that kind of horse, he also left this gaping hole open for anybody to come up inside of him.
Yeah, I mean, that was weird. I think maybe perhaps when he saw that 1,000 Words was the only other one showing speed, he didn't want to look like a jerk by getting into a speed duel with the two Baffert horses. That's the only thing that I can think of. But to me, the bigger shock was that Art Collector didn't go to the lead. That was shocking to me, and that Brian Hernandez took Art Collector back because, you know, especially with the being inside speed on that racetrack, going that slow, for him to be like fourth or fifth and wrangle back between horses down the backstretch, that was the shocking ride to me. Yeah, I agree with you that it was a little surprising to see Johnny not just take the bull by the horns. But I think that maybe he didn't want to get into a duel with the other Baffert horse. But explain to me why Art Collector wasn't on the lead going that slow, a horse that can go 23-46, as we saw in the Bluegrass and the Ellis Park Derby.
I know that, you know, there was a little bit of, hurly-burly off the break, and he didn't necessarily, you know, get into a position in the first few jumps that could place him that forwardly, and then next thing Hernandez seemed to know, he's kind of pinned in there, and there's horses in proximity, and they're not going that fast, so he sat, and that might have proven, fateful, and that's why Alvarado's ride is so laudatory, because saw the opening.
It reminded you, I'm sure you can relate to this, it reminded me of a New York turf race. I was talking about this on the podcast, about how New York turf racing, so many times people are like, no, you go, I don't want it, you go. That's the New York turf race a lot of the times, and I'm going 25 and 51, and it's super enraging as a horse player. It kind of reminded me of that.
Well, at the same time, I know that I heard Velasquez explain speculate that the horse kind of idled on him a little bit, and that he didn't necessarily get into that cruising gear on the backstretch like we saw him do at Churchill. And, you know, this is not to say, obviously, they didn't run a good race, because he obviously did. But he's a horse that's already been proven that you're better off letting him roll on the front end. And, I mean, that was really brought home, I mean, by his inability, to get by. Even Kenny said that it sure looked at the eighth pole that he was getting the measure of the filly, And also you could see that Johnny was using his left hand, the left rein, you know, trying to make sure that he was watching the, you know, that he had his eyeballs on the filly too, and to, you know, make sure that he was engaged. And I thought that, I don't know, I thought strategically he wasn't given the same chance that Johnny executed so beautifully at Churchill.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre to go 22-46 at Churchill Downs and win, and then go 24-48 at Pimlico and not be on the lead. Like, that, on its face, that doesn't make any sense. But, I mean, you touched on it. I think, you know, at the end of the day, we're all about wins and losses in racing. When it, you know, a lot of horses run great and don't win, and I think that was the case with him. And I got to give a lot of credit to Authentic, because I think that he was kind of the forgotten horse going into the Derby, because, I don't know, his Haskell, it's funny, because, like, I've never seen a horse win a grade $1 million race and get his stock downgraded as much as Authentic had in the Haskell, because he did have that big lead, and he almost blew it. He was really the forgotten horse going into the Derby, and, you know, it turns out he's one of the top two or three three-year-olds in the country at worst, and I think he did, you know, he covered more ground on the far turn than Swiss Skydiver did. I'm guessing the sheet figures are going to be pretty similar. So I think you got to give him a lot of credit for a horse that nobody really liked going into the Derby to run those two big races back-to-back. And he's got to be considered at least now, you know, if not neck and neck, then only a step or two behind Tis the Law for a champion three-year-old. And that's not something we saw coming going into the Derby.
No, well put. That, in fact, those battles kind of thrown into particularly Horse of the Year. We do have, going toward Keeneland, toward Breeders' Cup, some heretofore unconsidered options. I mean, if she goes and wins. She goes and wins Distaff. Kenny seemed a little bit more Distaffy this morning than he did yesterday and Saturday. But let's say she goes and wins the Distaff, and, you know, somebody other than Improbable or Tis the Law, I mean, or maybe Tom's the Tot, if somebody offbeat or, you know, a third, fourth, fifth choice type wins the Classic, why is she not Horse of the Year?
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely in the conversation. If she had won the Oaks, I felt like she would have a much stronger case.
Sure.
And if she doesn't go, if they decide not to run her in the Classic, I think if she had managed to win the Oaks, then I think she would be maybe the favorite at this point, honestly, after winning the Preakness. But just the fact that she ran second in the Oaks, she ran second in the Bluegrass, she did have that Alabama win, but I don't know what really was in that field. So to me, the only real top-class win she has is the Preakness win, and she's going to need a couple of things to break right, but yeah, she's certainly in the conversation.
We won't worry about Breeders' Cup right now. Let's continue to go through what was as mind-blowing a Saturday as you're going to come across. I mean, it just did not let up. And with the 11 o'clock start on Preakness Day, and then you start folding in the Keeneland card and the Belmont card, what else did you see that really struck you, Joe, over the weekend?
I got to start with Complexity, because he was a horse that, you know, flashed obviously very early on. He had the Champagne win, and then just completely was a total no-show in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile and the Woody Stevens. But then last year, towards the end of the year, he came back and he had this big blowout allowance optional claiming win at Aqueduct. And we did this thing on the podcast at the end of last year where we talked about kind of horses besides the three-year-olds, who we were looking forward to most in 2020, and mine was Complexity. And, you know, he shipped out west and ran in the Malibu, didn't run great. And he took a while to come along. And for him to run that well and be Code of Honor on the square in the Kelso, got a 110 buyer, I think he is potentially a superstar if he can keep it all together. He's obviously, you know, he might have some minor physical issues because he doesn't run all that often, and he's a little bit of an in and outer. But when he's right, I think he's one of the most talented horses in the country, and probably best at 7 furlongs to a mile. So maybe we'll see him in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. But he really, really impressed me, and it was gratifying to see him, you know, run that career top. Another big figure was Factor This in the dinner party. Fortis, yep. Formerly the Dixie, 110 turf fire. When's the last time you saw a 110 turf fire? Like Flintshire, maybe? I can't even remember when the last time I saw a turf figure that big was. So he's obviously coming on. He was second in the Turf Classic over at Churchill last time out. Even just beyond, Saturday, Ivar, I thought, was really interesting. I picked him on Twitter in the Shadwell Mile. Reason I picked him was because Spectacular Jam and Halliday both scratched, so I figured, okay, easy lead for him. Instead, he's mid-pack, makes this big sweeping move on the turn, and wins going away. So I think he's lightly raced. He's only run, I think, 7 times. He was a Group 1 winner in Brazil, and he's really coming on. I think he's super interesting. Also, Mo Forza out in the City of Hope Mile at Santa Anita. He's, like, seems like a real crack turf miler. Uni's return. Uni had been left for dead and comes back and wins the First Lady back-to-back. So I think, much as it was last year, I think this year the Breeders' Cup Mile is going to be one of the most fascinating races in the Breeders' Cup. And you know, we had that super exciting finish last year with the mares and the fillies going 1-2. I don't know if God Stormy is going to go back there again. I know she's been cut back. She's going to run, I think, this Friday at Keeneland, the 5.5 furlong turf sprint stake. But that race seems to be coming up super live. And then just yesterday, I thought Plum Ali was really, really good in the mm-hmm. in the Miss Grillo at Belmont. And she's 3-for-3 now, 2-year-old turf filly. So she's super interesting. But yeah, it was a smorgasbord of racing this weekend at Belmont, at Keeneland, at Pimlico, and just want to give a shout out to everybody at the TDN because, you know, we really worked hard and got the let out this weekend, because this was Saturday, I think, was one of the busiest non-Breeders' Cup days you'll ever see in the sport. It was a lot, but it was a lot of fun as well.
You hit a lot of the highlights, and one thing that, as you mentioned it, I made some notes, and you know, there were a handful of trainers, 7, 8, 9 trainers that won multiple, and if we fold in the last couple of weekends, you know, because there's been such intense action. But you mentioned Chad Brown and Complexity. Chad also, and Uni with the First Lady. But Chad also wins the Salima to open. It was so early in the day, people might not have even, you know, cleared the breakfast plates. When Fluffy Socks wins the Salima, and of course last week the Noble Damsel and the Violet. I mentioned Peter Miller earlier this morning too. In between the City of Hope, he wins the Zuma Beach. Last week the American Pharaoh, the CZ Rocket in the Sprint Championship, and he also won the Unzip Me. Brad Cox, you talk about what went on with Factor This, but you know, Juliet Foxtrot takes the Gallarette as well, and he wins the Breeders' Futurity with that Essential Quality, who really ran well, really well. So there was tons of this. Asmussen takes the boys' race and the girls' race, the Miss Preakness, with Wicked Whisper for the Lieblongs, and Yoppin was pretty much everybody's universal slam dunk. And, you know, very quietly, people might not have noticed, Mike Trombetta won the Ski Pat, the very one, and then the Belmont Turf Sprint yesterday with Wet
Your
Whistle. Yeah.
Yeah, it was up, funny. It was funny. Yesterday I was watching that race, which is a really interesting race, doing kind of a gutsy ride by Jose Ortiz, because he had the loose horse right from the jump, and he was kind of inside of the loose horse the whole way and really didn't let it affect him, I think. So that was a pretty gutsy ride. But it was funny, one of his post-race quotes, he said something like, when Mike Trombetta ships here, he's not playing games. It reminds me of one of your great lines. He doesn't ship on a lark.
That's a go-to. I've been keeping that. You have to dole them out. You can't go too often. It's like going right-handed too much.
That was one of the lines when you would pull the string on the Bic dial, and it would say it doesn't switch up on a lark.
Hey now.
How about the weekend that Luis Saez had at Keeneland? Monster weekend. He wins the Breeders' Futurity. He wins the Alcibiades. Yesterday he wins the Bourbon, Spinster. And then comes back and wins the Spinster with Valiance as well. I've always had a lot of affinity for Luis. I think he's one of the most underrated riders in the country, but it really shows when these guys go somewhere like Keeneland and dominate like that.
He also won for Rusty with Leinster in the Woodford.
That's right, yeah.
A couple of other multi-stake winners over the weekend. Bill Mott, of course, the Gallant Bloom, the Beldame, and the Joe Hirsch. Channelmaker. I certainly thought the Channelmaker could win. To win as dominant an effort, that was impressive. And
at 8 years old, no less.
Yeah. Well, there was a bunch of that. I mean, you also Lakey. We're going to talk to Damon Dillodovico later. He's got the 7-year-old sprinter that gets him the De Francis Dash and his first graded stake win. Christophe with one horse, one weekend performance we haven't talked about is Gouffo in the Belmont Derby, and it was a big weekend for Declaration of War. Every time you looked up, there was another Declaration of War winning.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a sire that was kind of forgotten about a little bit. He came in with a little bit of hype when he started his stallion career, and then I think kind of fell by the wayside a little bit. But yeah, he's produced some good horses this year. Think about Decorated Invader as well. There's a couple others. He had Silver Prospector, who was a pretty good 3-year-old earlier in the year. So yeah, he can get a good horse.
Well, and of course, you mentioned Plum Ali, and so there's the two Clement wins, and Mike Maker, who seems to have a horse in every single turf stake anywhere in the country of late, and that Evelyn wins the Hilltop, Catman, the Laurel Futurity, and then fold in that Fire at Will, speaking of Declaration of War, Fire at Will wins the Pilgrim, so three for Maker over the weekend as well.
Yeah, always dangerous in a turf race. Seems no matter what, turf, fillies, mares, colts, geldings, especially off the claim. Yeah, and you always got to give him a second look anytime he's in a turf-graded stake. He doesn't chip on a lark.
you've got obviously countless options going into the writers' room TDN show this week. What is McPeak the irresistible choice?
We finally got Kenny. We tried to have him on before the Alabama for Swiss Skydiver, and we weren't able to get him. We tried to have him on the week after the Alabama and weren't able to get him, but we corralled him. I think he's ready to do his press tour now with good reason.
Ready? He's ready 24/7. You could tape it at 2 a.m. and Kenny would jump aboard. He's such a fun interview, and he actually said some things today that I was unaware. You get frank response from Kenny, and he's unabashed.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things that you have to you really have to mention anytime you talk about successive horses of Swiss Skydiver, forget even just having the guts to run a filly against the boys. Just how about a $35,000 Keeneland September purchase, beating million-dollar horses on the regular? That to me is something that I think is really unique to Ken McPeak, is that he's regularly able to go find these bargain basement buys at Keeneland September, Basic October, one of these yearling sales or another, and just go up against these $500,000 high six-figure purchases, and his horses always seem to match up. I think that's something that's pretty unique to him, and I don't know what the secret sauce is, but whatever it is, like he knows how to dig deep and find those horses for relatively cheap. that can compete on the grade one level. I think that that's a real testament to his horsemanship as well.
No, no doubt. And we touched on that with Kenny this morning, and you know, Mark Cassie, we had that conversation during Keeneland, and it's one of another. He's another guy that, you know, can pluck him out on that front. And essentially, you know, it's looking at a young horse and being able to envision where the growth is going to come from, and you know what that horse will turn into. You know, then it's a question of, you know, matching up to client needs. And you know, Kenny's had a nice scenario when it comes to the client base. And you know, the you have to have the clients, you know, if you go, because he buys a lot of these on spec, and then, you know, turns to the, you know, the bench of client roster, and, you know, sort of shops them to, you know, the Herald Learners and the like, you know, as opposed to some people, you know, coming in and saying, I've got 750 to spend and I want three horses. You know, that you can do that too. And you know, Simply Ravishing is $250,000. It's not like, you know, it's not like she was in book five at Keeneland. So it's a great discussion. I mean, it's one of my favorite things. You know, Jimmy Ryerson's going to join us next. And Jimmy's horse, this Miss Marissa, was bought by Antonio Sano for the owner. And the Sano trains for the owner. And I'm anxious to hear from Jimmy, you know, how Miss Marissa came, you know, to him. But she was 11,000, Joe. I mean, that's a, you know, it's just very encouraging for people that have small budgets and small operations. When horses like this win these kinds of races, it's a big positive for the game.
That's the key point, is that I think that those are the stories that keep people on the lower level investing and dreaming in the game. And, you know, in a society where I think it's becoming less and less of a meritocracy, I think racing in America is one of those last bastions of a meritocracy where either the horse can run or the horse can't run. And, you know, if you have deeper pockets, you have statistically probably a better chance to finding a grade one classic winning horse, but it's no guarantee. You know, we've seen how much money Godolphin has spent over the years and trying to win the Kentucky Derby and still hasn't been able to do it. So this is a sport where the horses don't know how much they were paid for, and when they hit the track, it is completely irrelevant. It's whether or not they can run, and if you've got a sharp eye, even if you got a small budget, you can compete against some of the deepest pockets in the world. And that's not really a thing in the rest of America right now. It's much more skewed to the rich and the deep pocketed. But in racing, if you got a good horse, they can come from anywhere at any time for anybody.
There it is. Well said. And you can hear Joe on a regular basis with the TDN Writers Room podcast that drops on Wednesdays. And
I was waiting for you to fish that out. Yeah, Wednesday night usually.
Yeah, I always want to say Tuesday, but it's Wednesday, and yep. And then of course you Joe seems to be on you know every you know New York metropolitan sports telecast after big races. Joe's become
single-handedly bringing horse racing back to the sports newscast.
exactly. Joe, outstanding, and I appreciate it. We'll catch up toward Breeders' Cup. I want to get you out in front of some of a big weekend and get some opinions.
Yeah, you don't want to just hear about how great my opinions were after the fact.
That's okay, because you know if you couch them properly, it you know, people said yeah, they can picture that, they can understand that, you know, you had great opinions.
Yeah, let's do it.
I love it. Joe Bianca, everybody. And you follow Joe on Twitter, J Bianca TDN. J Bianca TDN. And if you're very clever, you might discover his secret original.
Jesus.
TDM, the original Twitter feed.
No room rating going on that account.
Oh, I love it. Joe, thanks, buddy.
All right, thanks, Steve.
Joe Bianca, terrific. And Joe has become just one of the top correspondent pundit types. Is that the app description? Yeah, I guess it is. Looking forward to talking to Jimmy Ryerson next. And Jimmy joins us now on the heels of the Black Eyed Susan win with Miss Marissa. And as dogged as the filly was for McPeak in the Preakness, the same can be said for Miss Marissa. And she did all the running and had enough to hold off an oncoming Bonnie South late. Jimmy, congratulations.
Steve, thank you very much.
I figured out a few little tidbits about this horse, and that included, you know, from the owner, and the fact that you and Antonio Sano trained for him. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how this all happened. Alfonso Camarota, yeah. And well, Miss Marissa.
Alfonso, he had been with Antonio Sano in Florida, and I guess he was looking. He had a New York bred filly, Conquest Hard Candy, a few years ago, and he's looking for somebody in New York. She was a New York bred. She had won a stake with Antonio, and he sent her. So it just so happens, the farm manager that he breaks his where he breaks his horses, Jose, they did a lot of work with Generazios, and so he recommended me up there, and that's how I started to work for Alfonso.
How nice. Very much like the Preakness winner, a modest purchase. I mean, this was an $11,000 OBS October yearling, and she really started, you know, solidly, has been tested along the way. I mean, has faced good company, Jimmy. You haven't been afraid to, you know, to put her up against some of the best of her, you know, of her age group. Talk about, you know, what you've got with her, and you know, what you learned along the way, and her topping out on Saturday with the Black Eyed Susan win.
Well, last year out of the group of young horses, I thought, you know, she was like the best of the bunch, and she ran well early. It was second at Belmont, and then I had I thought she'd stretch out, and we stretched her out at Saratoga on the turf, where she had a good bit of her family like the turf, and we ran into an American Pharoah filly of Todd's that was third in the Breeders' Cup, and her name eludes me, but
Sweet Melania.
She beat us there, and we backed up, you know, a little, pretty good. I was a little dismayed by that, so we turned her back to three quarters, and we caught Brad Cox's filly, who won the Breeders' Cup. We ran second.
So British idiom.
It was interesting, and she did face some nice fillies in just those three races she did, and we ran her a mile at Belmont, stretched her out, and she ran real well, and I thought she was going to be, you know, all right at the time, but the Frisette and the Demoiselle kind of cooled me off at that time, but this year when we finally stretched her out again, after a couple of decent races going 7/8, she's, you know, won three in a row. So it's you know, a new year. And, you know, I think one of the contributing factors probably is her weight. She's held her weight better. And she just improved going two turns, no question.
That's been a part of it, and for those that were trying to figure out how to find Miss Marissa at 10-1, one of the great indicators looking back, because I had her down underneath Jimmy. I had her like as a kind of a C horse in
right.
here. You faced Elders in that win mid Saratoga. And yeah. now coming back to three-year-olds, and you know, not that there weren't other horses in this field that had faced Elders, but that's a real indicator of quality. And I was kind of kicking myself regarding ticket construction. Yeah.
Well, what's happened this year, and you know, when she won the A other than at Monmouth, which was just for the race to go for the race. You know, you get an opportunity to run two turns. There aren't that many three-year-old filly races that were going. And then if you win that, then what do you do with a three-year-old filly? When with the pandemic, all these preps to the, you know, the cotillion and such, not only the cotillion canceled, but the preps to it are canceled. So
right,
you end up against older mares, you know, at Saratoga, but you know, we really didn't have that many spots to run in. Monmouth Park Oaks was kind of too close, and so we ended up getting a phone call up here in New York and to see if you know what I was doing with her. And there was going to be a small field, but there were some real nice fillies in there, Tommy Amos's filly, and we got lucky and you know, won it, so it was great.
Three straight, and you know, going into this with a mile and an eighth win under your belt, that actually, you know, was another major factor going into this. She was the only, for those that are realizing it after the fact, she was the only horse in the field with a win at the trip.
I think that was a big factor, and that's, you know, I'm not saying how far she'll eventually go, but you know, both times she's won two now at a mile and eight, so she can do it. But boy, Bonnie South was getting to her. I think the encouraging thing to me though was that it was only one horse getting to her, really. You know, so you know, a mile and an eighth is, you know, probably a good. You know, seems like, you know, she can handle pretty easy. You know, well.
Well, and there was also, there's another aspect to this. Not that she didn't sit at least early at Monmouth, you know, into the turn and on, but she took over on the backstretch pretty readily. And then, of course, she goes wire to wire and a lot of races at Saratoga at nine furlongs or one wire to wire. But she was very content to stalk Mizzen Bow in here. And Centeno, you know, I thought had a really nice, you know, nice seat on her, and she really was in hand for him.
Yeah, I think everybody, when they first looked at her paper prior to this race, oh boy, she, you know, looks like she wants to be in front, and you know, there's not, you know, she can do that. But I thought the Monmouth race, as you mentioned, indicated that she could sit a little. And that's kind of what we went into it, figuring that Norman's Cassie's filly may want to go also, because that seemed like that was her best race. So I think our ability to, you know, stalk and have the results we had at Monmouth, and you know, I think gave us the confidence that she could do it again, and she did. It did it even better this trip.
Well, and you know, I'm looking through the chart, and you come away, you know, not only with, you know, the Black Eyed Susan win, but you got bragging rights off over all your Mid-Atlantic cohorts, Margada and Butchie, and you get to hold sway.
Well, they're great guys. And Tony congratulated me after the race, and I, you know, I didn't see Jenny, or I saw Jenny prior to the race, but I didn't see her after. But yeah, listen, you know, it's it was good to see all them and be back in Maryland, where I had been, you know, 20 some years ago. I'd spent a couple winters there, and it was nice to be able to go back for a few days and see a lot of people I knew.
How do you move forward from this win with her? I mean, this was her sixth start of the year, and you know, fourth since mid June. Does she get a little bit of a break, or do you kind of keep an eye open? And how'd she come out of
it? It's interesting. I mean, we'll talk to Alfonso. I know, you know, prior to this, I had mentioned to him the Cumley at Aqueduct, and you know, at that time you've been kind of eliminated with the pandemic out of some 3-year-old filly spots throughout the year because of tracks changing and dropping some stakes and this and that. So to have a 3-year-old filly race, I think it's in November, third week of November or something, approximately. You have that I was welcome to see that, but we'll see. You know, we'll talk to him about it, and we'll see what we do. But we'll probably run her. Maybe we'll run her one more time, and then give her a little break.
Yeah, I just pulled up the stake schedule. It's not until November 27th.
That's a good time. That's a good bit of time. So we're gonna have to weigh what we're gonna do. So, you know, Alfonso, I'm sure, might have some other ideas. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, to get this win, and I couldn't find you on Twitter, but you know, I sent out the tweet, and you know, it's been, you know, a number of years since a graded stake win. I mean, you've had some really good years of late as well, but for whatever reason, just the you know, the graded stake. Right.
Yep, yes. I was lucky to be sent Fire Key last year, which it was very nice to have her. She was, you know, it was welcome to have her to be able to run, and we won a couple of stakes with her. But graded-wise, you got me here. It's probably, I mean, it could have been a while. I'm not even graded-wise. Are we talking
Park Avenue Ball?
The Hesses. Is that long?
Yep. Yep.
It is,
Jimmy.
That's interesting. But along the way, and you know, people, you know, we had some real nice horses for not only the Generazios, but for Leonard Pisnik, Aliui Benjay, and we were part of their careers. So, you know, and we're talking, of course, Lubash being one.
Sure.
And you know, and we had him for a couple of years, and he won 3 stakes with us. And Disco Partner.
Yeah.
Now, he placed, I didn't win with a graded, or whatever, to Troy, with Disco Partner for those years. So, it just so happens, even the other two different clients, they went on to go to Christoph. And he did such a great job with them. And then the big filly, I can't remember her name, for Generazios, that, you know, we had her early on and won a stake with her. And then as a 3-year-old, she went to Florida. And, you know, I've been staying up here. So they were
Cape Cod Carroll. Cape Cod Carroll.
Cape Cod Carroll?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we had Cape Cod Carroll, but the filly I'm thinking of is a real good turf, great filly for Clement that won the Del Mar Oaks. We broke her maiden. We won a stake with her at 2, and is a Generazio bred turf filly, and he sold her for like $2.9 million, and the name. Her name escapes me right now, but yeah, we've been part of the careers of some real nice horses while we've been up here in New York, and you know, and Christoph does such a good job. I mean, how can you ever, you know? I've been in the business a long time. Those things happen, but I also feel, as a team, we feel good that. In those cases, we were part of their careers, and they had long careers. So,
Absolutely.
And so that's, you know, listen, we enjoy being part of, you know, having that in our cap too. So.
Well, and when you mentioned, you know, you mentioned some of these clients that specifically Aliyu Benjay, and you know, brings to mind Metal Flight.
Right, Metal Flight. We had some, yeah, you know, we won the Flamengo and the Pennsylvania Derby, and Leonard was a longtime client, and his sons, you know, we have great relationships there. So it's all the part of, but yes, there was a long time, but I think even when we saw it, Park Avenue Ball, probably Disco Partner probably was more the, in terms of graded, you know, we were second in the Jaipur with him and stuff like that before he was taken over, you know, to Chris in the last 2 or 3 years. But, and he was just, you know, you couldn't, he was unbelievable. So, you know, that being said, those relationships and having those sources, whether you have them the whole career, whether you have them for 2 or 3 years, you know, it's just nice to have that, to be around those kind of horses.
Well, and you know, whether you get them mid-career or whether you start them, it's part of a program. And
for
Frank and Patricia Generacio, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, how much success they've had at this juncture in
absolutely,
you know, in
absolutely.
A career,
absolutely.
Right? It's, I mean,
that to handle that, you know, 20 some mares and to pretty much board out and to, you know, race your own and bring your own to the races and have the success they've had is unbelievable. So, so to be part of that, you know, has been great. And so, and Leonard has passed away, but I remember, I think Metal Flight was the first horse I ever bought him, and then you get back to, you know, Buzz Chase and those days. So it's all those relationships lead to, you know, you encounter to in this business, and they're special.
Yeah, you've no one questions the ability that Jim Ryerson's got with a horse with talent. And I, you know, you mentioned Mr. Pivnik, and I didn't realize until now that Buzz Baylor had bred him.
Yes.
I didn't realize. I didn't know that.
And Bluesowitz,
sure.
You know, he blew trained the Met Dam. She was a mile and an eighth. I think she went might have run in the Monmouth Park
Cassowary.
Huh?
Cassowary.
Yes.
A cormorant mare.
Cormorant mare. Yes.
Tough as you want to talk hickory. You want
No, absolutely, and. Going back, gosh, Nasty Cure was by Cure the Blues, and she was a tough, Buzz Chase bought her for $35,000, and she ended up throwing, first the horse called Net Kong, who made $300,000, but then
sure.
Lubash.
How funny
and
is
she
that?
She was a great purchase by Buzz. And, Lubash, you know, those New York bred stake races were unbelievable.
Yeah.
The two or three horses, I can't remember them now, but.
King Creesa. It was him, King Creesa, and.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And who was the third?
They were like dog fights. They were unbelievable.
Well, they're all together at Old Friends now. They're all running the fence. It's the craziest thing. We've also gone, you alluded to it without mentioning the name, but you know, for younger horse players and fans, Jimmy made Unbridled Song, and everything that Unbridled Song has brought to the sport and to the breeding shed starts with Jim Ryerson.
Well, thank you. I mean, that was he was special, and that goes back to relationships and developing young horses and people giving and seeing how you do with the Meadow Flight, and then that leads to a an Unbridled Song, and you know that, and that's the game.
It is the game. And and the business, and it's tough. I mean, it's because owners come and go, or owners die, which is the most difficult.
Right. Right.
You know, and not everybody, not everybody is out there, selling themselves like a roll of Bounty paper towel. It should be enough that the results, that owners see the results and understand what's gone into it. But it's not that simple. It makes it.
No, it's become tricky. A little bit more on a statistic end. And not who through the years who you develop. Really, it's all numbers, and that takes away from some of the smaller guys who had some. So who developed some horses, really.
Exactly. Well, Jimmy, I just was so thrilled watching on Saturday and knowing that was going to have the opportunity to have you on today, and congratulate you. And
thank you very much, Steve. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Not at all. And part of that advertising is getting out there on stuff like Twitter. It might a little. Jim Ryerson.
I know where you're going.
There's right. There's got to be somebody on the team that can
That's
handle
right.
it. All right.
Yes. All righty. Thank you.
Jimmy Ryerson, everybody, and I was introduced to Jimmy when working the barbecue and with Barbecue Bill, Bill Mayberry, and. As respected a horseman as there is anywhere in the game. And so happy for him to get his hands on this filly that 11,000, it's really, shows you what a team effort is, because Antonio Sano actually, bought this one for the owner, for Alfonso Camarada, and it came Jimmy's way, and look what's gone on here. And she obviously is still developing. So more to come. More to come this morning, too. Rich Migliore is going to join us after this. We'll talk to Rich. He's down at Timonium. We'll get a glance at the sale. We'll get some thoughts from him about the Preakness result and what he was watching at Belmont over the weekend. Then we've got Damon Dellavedova. Big win for him with Lackey. And Peter Miller is going to join us this morning as well. Peter with 5 stake wins the last 2 weekends. Back after this, hour 3 at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all 3 PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Sirius XM Sports.